You know what I don't understand?
Mm.
Like, how am I so sweaty? Like, I'm just sitting here talking. I don't understand why I'm perspiring this much. Welcome to VCR, a vintage cinema rewind. We're bringing old movies to new viewers. I'm Michael.
And I'm Jason.
And come here, I'll take your bear skin off.
About time.
Yeah, so it's our second Blakeless episode. It's a
Yes.
Michael and Jason solo adventure without
A
Blake.
duo. Yes,
Yeah, a
yes.
new the new dynamic duo. So yeah, and we are back with our deep dive on Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game.
Yeah, it was a fun it's a comedy, it's super fun, but also hard to get into because it is our French film. We're doing our international movie on in France. And yeah, there's a huge history of great films from France, and we thought we would bring it to the podcast.
Yeah, for sure. So, and yeah, when we decided we were gonna do France, we kicked a couple ideas around, and then I said, well, if we're gonna do a French, if we're gonna cover French cinema, we may as well talk about like the GOAT, like the OG, like the quintessential French masterpiece. And here we are.
Yep, we're starting at the beginning almost of French cinema. Not exactly, but like this is where they've really like made a name for itself, I think.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, yeah, and again, we talked about this in the spoiler-free episode. This is almost kind of like the French Citizen Kane. Or maybe like Citizen Kane is the American Rules of the Game, because this came out like what, 4 or 5 years before Citizen Kane?
Yeah, I think so. And there's, yeah, there. Those two are compared a lot, for mostly, I think, the technical reasons, and we'll get into that a little bit because the way this movie was shot was pretty incredible for the time, and really, like, there's a lot to dissect.
There certainly is. So, where should we get started? Do you want to talk about the techniques right away, or should we just talk? Actually, why don't we just talk about the plot? Because, like, there's a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah, I like that.
Jumping right into it, I guess. Like, I don't know. Was there any. Let me just ask you, Jason, while you're getting out of your bear skin, like, were there any particular, like, scenes or characters that you, like, particularly enjoyed?
It's difficult to pick any for me because there's just so much to unpack. I have to rewatch this because like I know it needs a second viewing to
Oh, for
fully
sure.
get like the there's a lot of comedy and a lot of gravity to I think you really have to soak it in and absorb a lot. And the first viewing is, it throws a lot at you. But I will say the beginning scenes, so we are introduced to Andre, the aviator, and he is just getting into aristocratic society
Yeah.
with this huge feat of crossing the Atlantic in a plane. That like that introduces you to the concept because he does the whole point of him doing it was for this woman Christine who doesn't show up.
His married lover. Yeah. Although, to be fair, okay, first of all, I really liked just the big burly like oven mitts he was wearing when he got out of the plane. I
Oh
don't know if
yeah.
that's standard issue for aviators, but I was just like, oh, that's so cute. Like, look at those big mittens. But I did want to ask, like, for the first hour at least, it seemed really ambiguous whether or not the affection between Andre and Christine was mutual. Like, it seemed a little ambiguous whether or not they were actually involved in some sort of affair. Or if, like, maybe Andre had just misunderstood her affections.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of like that's discussed later in the film by between Christine and Octave, his best friend, and her childhood friend, or like they've known each other for a long time.
Octave kind of has this moment where he kind of admonishes her and he's like, oh, you're like a 12-year-old girl. You just throw yourself around the necks of whoever you please. And like, it confuses people, right?
So yeah, like this guy is coming into this society. And we're introduced very quickly to it where adultery is the name of the game.
Yep.
And that really is a core concept of the movie. And it has a double meaning that has to do with World War II. So there's a lot to unpack there. But in the beginning, yeah, you see him do this great feat for a woman, and it seems like it's an unrequited love type thing. And then we cut to Christine speaking with her maid, Lisette, and she's like, do you have any lovers? And she's like, lovers, that's a big word. And like, she's married as well. And so you get thrown right into this where everybody seems to have lovers, because we see Andre is a potential lover of Christine, and then Lisette has some lovers, and it's brought up right away. So yeah, you're introduced to this game that they're playing.
Mm-hmm. And then Robert, Christine's husband, also has his mistress that, like, you know, and again, like I mentioned in the spoiler-free episode, he tries to break it off with her right away, but then again, like, you know, he's immediately backs out. Although, to Robert's credit, I will say he does back out of it for real later on.
Yeah, he does. Well, does it actually end? We don't really know.
Yeah.
Because this is all just one weekend, one crazy weekend. Yeah, so I guess the overall plot point to say is this is a weekend away for a bunch of aristocrats at a chateau where they're doing their big annual hunt. And it's like rabbit and pheasant hunt. And that rabbit and pheasant hunt scene is huge for cinema at this time.
Oh, God. It's kind of funny. So Blake and I did Watership Down earlier this month. It's April when we're recording this. And then there's this rabbit hunt scene where, like, you just see all these French aristocrats just gunning down hordes and hordes and hordes of rabbits. And I remember, like, watching this on Saturday, I was thinking, like, oh, I guess from now on, April is Animal Cruelty Month at Vintage Cinema Rewind.
I guess so.
One shot in particular that I remember, like, it stuck with me for 13 years. It's when the guy shoots the rabbit flops over, and you see it, like, tremble and kind of, like, curl up into a ball before dying.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember watching this movie in film school, like, 13, 14 years ago, and being like, either that rabbit is a phenomenal actor or it just fucking died.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And yeah, this is 1939, so they just did it with, like, they filmed a bunch of rabbits and pheasants getting actually hunted, and I want to say the actors are actually shooting, like, I don't know if we see that directly, but somebody's shooting these rabbits on film, and it's like a long sequence with a lot of cuts, and it's a little chaotic. There's a lot going on, while there's also this undercurrent of who's doing what with who, because there's even more adultery going on. Like, I didn't expect there to be that many affairs in, like, the first 20 minutes of this movie. Like, almost all of them are uncovered.
It's funny. So again, they invite Andre, and, like, yeah, before we move on, just on the rabbit hunt scene, I remember talking to my professor back in film school and being like, wow, those rabbits, like, they really shot a lot of rabbits. And my professor was like, oh, you think that's bad? Like, think about all the rabbits they shot and filmed that never even made it into the movie. Like, think of all all the dead rabbits on the cutting room floor. Like, I was like, oof. Yeah. So again, they invite Andre to this chateau because they want to smooth things over with the aristocracy. And then I think it's Robert who gets up and gives an announcement in front of everyone where he sort of plays off. No, it's Christine who goes up and delivers this big announcement where she's like, oh, like, Andre and I spent many, many, many long, pleasurable hours together in friendship, where he told me about all his, like, all his goals and dreams and aspirations and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then we see all these, like, little private conversations where, like, nobody's fucking buying it, but, like, that's their whole idea of, we're going to smooth this whole thing over and we're going to whatever, right? But then, again, nobody's buying it. And, yeah, the affairs continue on.
Yeah. And through this, we are seeing the interaction of the aristocrats and their staff and how they interact with each other, like, separately, how the staff is acting and then how the aristocrats are acting and then how they interact with each other. And there's a lot of mirroring going on where Lisette is having affairs that are reminiscent of Christine's affairs.
Lisette is almost like going after it with like more gusto. Like she cannot be contained. It's really funny. So Marceau, the poacher, she ends up having an affair with him. It's so funny. Like there's that scene where you see all the servants eating together in like the basement, basically. And then she's like, "Oh, Marceau, like you can sit right here at my right." And then like, less than a minute later, he's like eating bread or something, and he's giving her like these very flirtatious look while he's eating bread.
And it's so off-putting, and like obviously this like Marceau is one of the most comedic characters in the film.
For sure. Yeah,
the way he's like giving her those eyes and everything, it's pretty funny.
We say it's off-putting, but it clearly worked. So like, who are we to judge?
Yeah, exactly. So while they're all sitting down, the staff, they're speaking about this André Giroux coming in, and they're like, obviously they're having an affair, and like they're all speaking about the affair openly within themselves, but they can't mention it to the aristocrats. And then the aristocrats also are all speaking within themselves about the affair. So everybody knows, and everybody accepts that they know, and they just, there are rules to the game.
Yeah. And like, and maybe we should talk about André now, because André sort of sticks out like a sore thumb, because he either doesn't understand the rules or he's just willfully choosing not to play by them. You know, there's this great scene with him and Octave where it's really funny. They're sharing a room. So like they have these two single beds right next to each other. And Octave, and again, we should talk more about Octave later, but Octave understands these people and he knows how to like twist them to his own ends. So he comes in and he's in a good mood, and Andre's sitting on the bed and he looks really like despondent and upset. And Octave's basically like, "Oh wow, everything's going over really well, blah 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 blah." And Andre's basically just like, "I'm leaving. Like, fuck this place. Like, this sucks." And Octave's like, "You can't leave after all the work I've done." So like,
yeah. It's like André is a referee of this rules, like of the rules of this game, because he's smoothing over the relationship between André and Christine with the Robert, the
husband, the lord or whatever. So
yeah, and then he also ends up like he's smoothing everything over, and he's kind of like assisting everybody in staying within the rules of the game.
He kind of reminded me of almost like an Odysseus figure, where it's almost sort of like he's kind of this down on his luck guy, but like he can move through this world because he just understands how to like charm and manipulate these people, right? He knows how to play them to his old ends.
That's a great point, because he isn't like a pure-blooded aristocrat. Like he has made it to this level just by being the one who smooths everything over and has great relationships with everybody. So he's playing the game at like a higher level because he has to skirt in.
Yeah, he's almost like and like the whole idea of like, let's invite everyone to the chateau and let's invite André and we'll smooth everything over, like it's all his idea, right? And like, even like, it's almost like he's almost like, there's no real main character in this movie. I think, you know, Jean Renoir famously said that this is more about a world than a single hero.
Yeah.
But like, even Octave is almost kind of the closest we get to a protagonist, because it's his actions that are kind of guiding a lot of the plot, right? Like, so in the beginning, André's super heartbroken and like almost suicidal about, you know, Christine not, you know, showing up for him. You know, Octave is really mad at him for almost getting him involved in a car wreck. I mean, understandable. And then Octave's one's like, all right, like, I'll take care of it. And then he goes to Robert and he's like, let's invite this André guy to your chateau and we'll smooth it all over, right? So, like, he's almost like, he's really, it's interesting. Like, I almost feel like you should show this movie to, like, political science majors, because it's such a weird, complex study on power, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. He also is playing, he's setting up, like, he understands Robert and Genevieve's relationship, and I thought initially that he was going to set Genevieve up with Andre to solve the whole problem. And I think that was his goal originally, but things are just so chaotic that like he can't pull
he can't even keep up with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He also says like the most famous line in the movie, which I wrote it down because it was such a good line. When he's talking to Robert about how to smooth everything over, he basically says, "The awful thing about life is this. Everyone has their reasons." And like, I was already enjoying the movie, but when that quote, when he said that quote, I sat up a little straighter. I was like, "Oh, interesting. Like, this movie has more to say than I thought it did."
Yeah, yeah, it's like it's condemning but also uplifting a little bit, where he's basically saying like each person is out for themselves, but then everyone knows that each other are.
I saw it more as him saying like everyone is more complex than we give them credit for.
Yeah, that's true actually. Yeah. And this is everyone, like each character is fairly complex for being like a this is like a satirical comedy.
Like a goofy, farcical French movie, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then going back to Andre, again, he really stuck out like a sore thumb to me because like he almost kind of reminded me of like Ned Stark in the first season of Game of Thrones, right? Where it's like he's an honest man in a like compulsively dishonest place, you know?
That's very apt.
He's like, okay, so later on, him and Christine sort of reconcile and they decide that they're going to run away together. And Christine is basically just like, let's go. And Andre's like, no, I have to go talk to your husband.
Mm-hmm.
And Christine is like, wait, you're going to do what? And Andre's like, well, like, he's the host and I'm his guest. Like, it would only be polite for me to, like, talk to him about all this.
Yeah, yeah. It's like he gets the game, but then he doesn't want to play it, but then he ends up playing it.
Right. Well, it's almost like he gets killed because he refuses to play by the rules.
And that is the same. Like, him and Schumacher are the only two who don't want to play by the rules. And, like, that's a big point here, is if you don't play by the rules, you're going to get bit.
You're going to get shot. Because
Schumacher ended up being a murderer. Like, he ended up murdering Andre. So both of them are, like, connected in the fact that they don't want to play the rules. They want to be passionate and, like, loyal.
Yeah, they want to be honest. They want to be honest men, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that is mentioned early in the movie where I think, like, the general that's bumbling around this mansion and everybody's kind of, like, being very proper around him and not playing the game in front of him. He says to Andre, like, you're an honest man. Like, you're a great man. There's not many left like that.
Yeah, that is, I forgot about that. That is a really good point. There's also, I think it's one of my other favorite quotes from this movie is Genevieve. She says like, oh, sincere people are such bores.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. And again, maybe just going back to the historical context a bit, the reason this movie was so, it was considered so incendiary back in 1939 is because, you know, World War II was just around the corner and everyone knew it. And here comes this movie, this show that like, instead of preparing for war or like fighting fascism, our leaders are just running around fucking each other.
And it's a commentary on class, and they are basically like, this movie shows a mirror to the French people to say like, this is why we're going to war, because the elite French people, the aristocrats, are off hunting and enjoying their lands separated from the reality, and they know they can just go off, they can escape the war so easily because they're rich. And then like the people serving them are so focused on that, that like they can't do anything about what's coming.
Yeah, it's almost like, so the elites are too busy just playing their stupid trivial little games, and everyone else is just so focused on emulating their quote-unquote betters that,
yeah,
you know, and yeah, that's why fascism That's why they weren't prepared for fascism, right?
Yeah, and that's actually still like an accurate thing today when you look at how placated the masses sometimes can be when they're like trying to play this like ladder of
this economy. Game, right?
The lower class doesn't want to believe they're lower class, so they emulate the upper class and they ignore what's actually going on to keep them down.
Well, I mean, how, like, let's be honest, like, how many of us, how much energy do we waste in, like, 2024, like, the age of, like, social media and all that digital connection, whatever, how much energy do we waste trying to appear more, like, higher class than we actually are? Or just, how much energy do we waste trying to appear more together than we actually are? So, I'm going to throw myself under the bus right now, so stand back. I got a Facebook memory. By the way, you want to know how old I am? I still use fucking Facebook. But anyways, I got a Facebook memory from 2 years ago, and I had mentioned, I was talking about being close to finishing this book, and I responded that I shared that memory and then just wrote, here's all the things I accomplished in the last 2 years. And like, it was really cool and all that stuff, but it was also kind of like, why did you fucking share that? Like, you know, there was also, sure, you did a lot in the last 2 years, Michael. There's also a lot of you just wasting time, like pursuing things you shouldn't have been pursuing, blah, blah, blah. I don't know why I'm humiliating myself on our podcast, but here I am.
there is a parallel to the movie where like you're kind of like André Giraud doing something for some reason and you don't know why.
Were back then. Yeah, I'm like André because I'm admitting it. Like most people would just be like, no, like, you know, everything's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like for me, and a lot of people in the world, with social media, we post only photos of us doing cool shit. So like I went to New Orleans and posted some stuff. And it's like that's what the rich are doing. And I'm going to go do that and post it and post my best, like the best little tidbit of my life on social media. And it's like this group of people going off hunting and the help, they're all like trying to emulate them as well.
Before we move on from this point, I did want to point out, are you familiar with The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe?
Not that one, no.
Okay, so it's a famous Edgar Allan Poe short story where basically the whole premise is there's a plague going on, and instead of doing anything about it, Prince Prospero locks him and his like rich and famous friends inside his palace or chateau, and they basically decide they're just going to party until the plague is over, right? So you've got this plague ravaging the whole world, but then all these rich assholes locked in their chateau just having a mask ball that goes on forever, right? But then a mysterious stranger arrives in a red mask, and as soon as he arrives, people start dying. And it turns out basically the premise is death has arrived in a red mask, right?
Wow. That is so accurate because they were planning a masquerade at this chateau.
Yeah, right?
For André's achievements or something like that. And then it didn't happen, but I guess it kind of did. They had like a whole play and everything. And in the movie, the characters put on this play and they put on Danse Macabre.
Yeah.
Which like I had to look that up. Like that's a common theme in old cinema, but this is like a straight up allegory of it doesn't matter who you are, we're all dancing towards death.
Basically.
Whether you're higher class or lower class, it doesn't matter like what you do, we're all the same.
We're all going to fucking die. That's a big
theme within this.
Right. So I wonder if that was an inspiration for this movie. Because again, yeah, you're right. They do just the whole premise of the original short story is like, again, these rich assholes lock themselves away to ignore the problems of the world. And then death literally comes knocking and kills them all. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's kind of, there are definitely a lot of allusions to that short story in this movie.
You could also see it in some modern cinema, which Blake and I would, during these episodes, we would normally like compare some movies. We should have probably brought this up in the primer. But,
well, Blake isn't here and we're doing our best.
Yeah. So Parasite and Saltburn are two direct comparisons that I thought of when watching this movie or afterwards. Okay. Where Saltburn is all like directly about like rich assholes and a guy like infiltrating that society and pretending to be like them to gain their trust and everything. And so if you've seen that, like there is a comparison to be had here. And then Parasite also is like the most modern representation of like the class struggle.
Right, yeah.
The parasites work their way into the rich family's service so that they can live the good life that they wouldn't be able to as lower class. Mm. And like we see Marceau do that.
We sure do, yeah. That guy is a straight up social climber. He's an opportunist.
Yeah, and so is Octave.
Mm-hmm. Octave's an interesting character too, because he spends most of the movie just kind of pulling all these strings, but then we learn later on. So basically the whole idea is he's really close with Christine because her father was like this famous Austrian conductor, and Octave actually studied under him.
Oh, right.
And so they're almost kind of like brother and sister because that's their connection. But then we kind of see later, Octave has this really vulnerable moment where he admits that he considers himself a failure.
Mm.
It's almost like he wanted to pursue the arts or pursue his passion, but instead he just became this sort of, I don't even know what you'd call him, like this sort of babysitter for all these rich people.
Yeah, because that's like where he ended up at the bottom of the top.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. The bottom of the top, right? Or like,
yeah,
he's among these, he can move through these crowds, but he's not really ever a part of them.
Yeah, like he's never the one that's needs, like he's the fixer. He's never needs the fixing. And then like he does admit his love for Christine in the end, but like, that's just another layer of crazy love connections on top of that.
We should talk about that. So Robert decides to break things off with Genevieve, and he does this at the rabbit hunt. And then Christine just so happens to be fucking around with these binoculars, and she catches them being a little too physically intimate, and she misunderstands, right? It's a classical, like, kind of romantic comedy farce trope, right? A misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. So then it's interesting. Everyone else seems, like, Robert seems to be fully aware of her affair with Andre, but she didn't seem to have any idea of his affair with Genevieve.
Yeah, but then later she acts as if she knew to speak with Genevieve about it. And is like, men are all pigs again, I think.
They kind of have this weird like sisterhood moment where they almost kind of bond over how awful men are, blah, 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 right?
And that goes, I think, like, so there are so many mirrored, like, intentional mirroring happening within this movie where there's like a men versus women and a upper class versus lower class at like... So I think that's another one where the women are saying that kind of stuff, but then the men are saying like, oh, she's so like, she's throwing herself at men, like all women kind of do. Like that's not as strong, I guess, as the other mirrors, but I'm just seeing like how well I think Jean Renoir wrote everything.
Yeah. How well he understood all these, this like web of connections. Right. And then actually on that point, when Andre and Robert also have a weird kind of like bro moment where like, you know, they, you know, Schumacher catches Marceau canoodling with his wife and he chases him through the chateau shooting at him. And then, Andre and Robert kind of have this moment where basically Robert sort of gives him his blessing and is like, all right, go, like, you know. And Robert kind of says, like, I love her and I want her to be happy. So, yeah, go nuts. Like,
yeah, yeah. But then he almost, like, I think he was implying that he would give Andre some money too, because he's like Christine has needs, which is repeated a few times.
Yeah, that's a common thing. Yeah.
Later by Lisette, where like Lisette would love to go off and marry for love kind of thing with Andre or Octave. And then we see that repeated where Robert is like, you don't have that much money, to Andre. And then Lisette is like, you don't have any money, to Octave.
Yeah.
So Robert understands what's going on and is willing to give his wife away. But he's also like becomes best friends kind of with Andre because they share the same plight of loving women.
I suppose. Yeah. Robert actually, he kind of turns out to be sort of a decent guy, I guess, where like he seems to genuinely love Christine and genuinely want her to be happy, even if it's with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So that is kind of an interesting little wrinkle in this whole thing. By the way, I think one of my favorite moments in this whole movie is when Andre runs off to go be with Christine and Lisette starts crying because she doesn't want Christine to go. And then Robert turns around and he's like, please, Lisette, like, I'm not crying.
yeah. Yeah. I think when you take a step back from this huge web of affairs and like unrequited love and hidden love, like all of these different, when you take a step back, the commentary is kind of that nobody in this situation wants to be in this situation, but they have to play the game. So they're all stuck within this loop of love and affairs. None of them really want that, but they seem to be just playing the game because that's what they do.
I don't know. I don't know that I would agree. I think a lot of them are more or less content to play the game, and that at the end of the day, it is almost kind of just a game. I consulted with the old master. I read Roger Ebert's review of this movie, and I just want to share a quote from his review.
Yeah, definitely.
Where he basically says, "It is interesting how little actual sexual passion is expressed in the movie. Schumacher, the gamekeeper, is eager to exercise his marital duties, but Lisette cannot stand his touch and prefers for him to stay in the country while she stays in town as Christine's maid. The aviator's love for Christine is entirely in his mind. The poacher Marceau would rather chase Lisette than catch her. Robert and his mistress, Genevieve, savor the act of illicit meetings more than anything they might actually do at them. It is indeed all a game, in which you may have a lover if you respect your spouse and do not make the mistake of taking romance seriously. The destinies of the gamekeeper and the aviator come together because they both labor under the illusion that they are sincere. I said they are two of the three who play by the rules of the game, but alas, they are not playing the same game as the others."
Yeah, that's very apt. Yeah, like how far do you delve into all of this? Because when I took a step back and saw the whole game that they're playing, I don't think, yeah, like some of them were playing the same game, some of them weren't. The ones who weren't got hurt. Because, I don't think any of them really want to be playing the game, but the only two who didn't got hurt.
My interpretation was more, this is almost just kind of, again, especially when you look at this as in its historical context with World War II just around the corner, and, you know, the fact that with World War II around the corner, and apparently Jean Renoir was like a very staunch, like anti-fascist, and was really concerned about the direction his country was heading. I almost kind of see it as like, this is all just kind of a grand diversion, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
This, all these affairs, all this trickery, all this whatever, like it's all just an extension of the masquerade, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was my interpretation anyway.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do a rewatch because like there's all these little things that I caught and like trying to connect them to the big picture. You can't just do it on one watch, I think. And that's why there's so many video essays about this movie. Like, there's a lot to discuss. One, let's go back to some more fun stuff, I think.
Okay, yeah.
Like, we probably don't have the full grasp, but we can, like, pick at it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
When it came to Schumacher hunting Marceau, that was probably, like, around the same point, but at the end of the movie, as the original hunt. So it's mirrored by the hunt.
Mm.
So Marceau is a rabbit. And even the camera work during that Schumacher hunting Marceau scene was moving just as quick as the rabbit hunting scene earlier.
Mm.
And when you said in the primer about Robert, he didn't want fences, but he wanted the rabbits gone.
Yeah.
Like, that detail means a lot to me because of World War II.
Yeah, that's a good point. Or almost like, I don't want Nazis in my backyard, but I'm not really willing to do anything about it.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you can compare it a few different ways.
It is, like, I do really find this whole movie interesting in that it's basically, it's a condemnation on the whole of French society for not doing enough to stop the Nazis. And yet, there's not a single Nazi in this movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It almost kind of, I remember studying film noir again back in film school, and you know, they talked about how, like, back in the 40s they had certain rules about what you could show on screen and what you couldn't. So, like, film noir was kind of like, well, we can't really show the war directly, so, like, we're going to have to just communicate the angst in, like, a really creative way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the vibe I got with this movie.
And it's, like, almost reflected with, like, there's a lot of implications of sexual activity, but you don't see that much besides a few kisses, and the kisses aren't even, like, that crazy or anything.
No, like, it's, I think there's a moment where, like, Marceau and Lisette are kind of, like, in each other's arms and, like, being a little, like smoochy,
yeah.
But, like, that's about it, you know? Even towards the end, when Christine tells Octave that she realizes she's the one, he's the one that she's always loved, I was kind of like, lol, what? Okay. So.
Yeah, and, like, she has been trying to play this game, but she's an outsider who stepped into the, like, she was an aristocrat elsewhere and then stepped into Parisian aristocracy.
Sure, yeah.
And she's just so, like, tumbled around because of her position and her beauty and just, like, her station. Like, almost everybody was in love with her.
That's actually a really good point. Like, I do remember watching this movie for the first time, again, like, 14 years ago. And when she says, like, oh, it's you I've always loved, I was like, what?
Yeah.
And now watching this movie again 14 years later with, like, fresh off a heartbreak and
mm-hmm.
with male pattern baldness finally catching up with me, her saying, like, I've always loved you, I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. It's very, everything in this movie feels very trivial and very frivolous, but that's kind of the point. And that's kind of the satire or the condemnation that they're going for.
Yeah, and like we said in the primer, the French viewers and the audience, they took that all quite poorly. Like, it was too serious for them. It was too real for them that they were, like, this was, they like, it's like they had no problem like, making fun of others, but then when the film was standing there right in front of them making fun of them for, like, and, like, too on the nose for them, they couldn't handle it. So, like you said, the one guy tried to burn it down, there were fights in the crowds, Jean Renoir had to cut, like, 8 minutes off the film just to be allowed to continue to put it into cinemas, and then after that they had to cut another bunch. And yeah, it was, and again, this was, I think, 3 months before the actual start of World War II.
It's pretty crazy how he was basically wagging his finger at all of French society, being like, you're too busy fucking each other to stop the Nazis.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, 3 months later, he's like, ah, what did I say?
Yeah.
Here they are. But I mean, again, it's like I said, it's kind of a miracle this movie exists at all in the form it does, because I think, yeah, I think like 1956, they discovered some old reels and they like cut together the more complete version. And yeah, I mean, do you consider this movie a masterpiece?
I think I can allow that qualification off of one view based on how much it's making me think and try to pull pieces from it and say, like, how does this fit into the big picture? What was he actually trying to say? Because like it deserves a look, a deep look, because of like all of the, like, there's depth there that's hidden behind such like farcical surface level bullshit of this game. And like, I want to know
so
yes, I think it does kind of deserve that.
I would agree. I mean, I really think we should maybe do more movies from this director's filmography, because I'm curious to see what else he's accomplished and what else he's done. But like, I really enjoyed rewatching this movie, and like, yeah, I would really like to see what else this guy has to offer.
So there were two films that he did before this. He started out with a bunch of short films, but there were two direct ones where he had like great success for the first two, and like you almost want to watch them as a trilogy, I think. The Grand Illusion is a 1937 one. And
yeah, that's his, I think that's like his most popular one, right?
Yeah, it has like higher ratings, and I saw other people like who were reviewing The Rules of the Game and saying The Grand Illusion was better. Maybe not as impactful, but if this one was considered a masterpiece, he had to have, because of the, like the social commentary that it sparked, I'm sure his other ones are like just as good.
Yeah, I really want to see more from this guy. And like, I want to say another thing is, a lot of the times when you rewatch old movies, you kind of, the acting isn't always on point, you know? Yeah. I remember, this is probably going to get me some flack from like film purists, but like, I tried watching The Searchers, you know, the John Ford Western from like the 50s with John Wayne. It's like considered one of the greatest studio era movies of all time. It's from like the 50s or something. I watched it 3-ish years ago, and the acting was just so cheesy that it was just really hard for me to take seriously.
Yeah.
But I will say, watching this movie from 1939, I will say the actors are all phenomenal, right? Like, even Octave, like the director, everybody turns in a phenomenal performance. Like, I remember there's that moment where like, after Schumacher has been dismissed for, you know, firing his gun throughout the chateau, you know, Marceau finds him a few minutes later crying behind a tree. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching this movie for the first time 14 years ago and just being like, oh, that motherfucker is actually crying.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I was very surprised as well. Like, I've seen some other movies like close to this period, and like, of course, we're only watching some of the best of this period, but this one, like, there was very little to talk about when it came to like poor acting. Like the majority was all phenomenal, really.
Yeah, no, I don't even think I'd point out like a single performance that, yeah, kind of,
I wouldn't say it phoned it necessarily in. A performance, it's just like how it was shot in that time, it made sense. Like some of the screaming and fighting, like the fights didn't look real.
Yeah, that's a good point. And yeah,
like they were very silly, but maybe they did that completely on purpose to say like these aristocrats don't know how to fight.
The losers. Yeah.
But that's also so, like, fighting in movies has been traditionally pretty poor in old movies, and then like some new movies as well. But
I remember watching The Godfather again with Blake last February, and like there's that scene where James Caan is punching that guy, and like his fist is very clearly not connected.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you're just like, well, shit. Like, oh well.
I guess we should probably get to the effects and filming just because we're talking a little bit about that, like the fight scenes.
That's a good point.
Just so much was always going on in the camera. And this is basically like a big portion of what cements this as a masterpiece, because it was the first to do this and they nailed it with the, it's from what I researched, like blocking. So you have the foreground, background, and midground, and that, as well as the deep focus and different panning techniques.
Maybe we should explain what deep focus is. Basically, deep focus is just, it's basically just when the whole screen is in focus, right? Like a lot of the times the director will put, you know, either the foreground in focus or something in the background in focus. But like deep focus is when, the whole screen is just crystal clear in focus, right? Yeah,
so you see what's going on in the background, and Jean Renoir like specifically has certain things going on in the background that are directly related to the foreground. So just the just the fact that they had the cameras that tuned to be able to show it all is a impressive technical feat. But then just the directing of actually using that space, it's like he was always wanted to use it but wasn't able to until they got this in, and he's like, this is how it's going to work from now on in film history forever.
Basically, like, I think Citizen Kane is considered a pioneer in deep focus cinematography, but this movie was doing that 2 years earlier, and it's really interesting. Like, and this kind of speaks to like the whole theme and topic of this movie, where like, you know, you've got the higher classes and the lower classes and the masters and the servants, but there's so many moments where like two characters in the foreground will be talking, and then you've got two characters in the background doing something completely unrelated or almost completely ironic, you know?
Or there's a scene when Andre first shows up to the chateau, and the aristocrats exit that scene together while their two counterpart helpers exit from the back, and like they're off going to do different things. So like that's when you see the separation, and then like the next two scenes are what happened to those people as they exited. So like how they exited led to the next two scenes.
Yeah, it's really cool. There's the one shot that I really liked is you've got Marceau and Lisette kind of like, again, canoodling with each other. And then while they're in the basement in like the servants' quarters, you know, being romantic. And then you see Schumacher, Lisette's husband, approaching from the background, and you're just like, oh shit.
Yeah. Like, you know? So you know before they know, and it's all shown and like in it, like a long cut scene.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, the other thing we should talk about in terms of effects and filmmaking. There's a lot of long shots in this movie. Like, there's actually, this movie almost feels like a filmed play in terms of the fact that there's not a lot of cutting.
Yeah, and if there was cutting, like, it was done very seamlessly. Things move from one scene to another so well, which is almost unheard of when you're watching some, like, very old movies like this.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the reason why I personally think this movie holds up so well, is that it feels very modern in terms of just the deep focus cinematography, the long shots, all that stuff. Like, it just all very, it blends together very seamlessly.
To that point, the camera, it has, I read this in somebody else's review and it clicked automatically, where I was like, that is exactly like what I think Jean Renoir was doing. The camera is at eye level almost all the time, as if you are standing there watching around, and like the way the focus, where the camera's focusing, is almost as if you were on the other side of the room and you saw this game being played, and you're one of the guests in the house who's not one of the main eight, and you're like trying to like crane your neck to around someone to see like, oh, what are those crazy fuckers doing over there?
Yeah, what's going on now? Yeah, it's almost like you're a guest at the chateau, right? That's a good way of putting it.
And then my other scene, just to talk about the use of the the depth is the hallway outside of everybody's, all the guests' bedrooms. They played with that a few times where, like after the ball or whatever, everyone's going to bed. And that was just like fun showing off the technical prowess of the camera, where like, Andre was like going up and down saying goodnight to everybody, and like people were coming out of their rooms and then into another room, all of that. That was a really fun use of that. I think that like viewers of this in 1939, even though they were so upset by the content, they probably would have been like, wow, that's cool.
I mean, even like, you know, it's been like almost 90 years. Even I'm still like, wow, that's cool. Like they actually, they pulled it off. Like that's pretty cool, right? Yeah. Like, I think the third act in particular, when like, you know, there's the masquerade and you've got Schumacher chasing Marceau around and shooting at him. Like there's so many moments where I'm just like, what, like, how did they pull this off? Like, you know,
yeah.
With the technology at the time.
Also with this, they like Jean Renoir used mirrors as like people in the background. You could see them through the mirror of the foreground. So often, like that was unheard of, and like some of the best technical scenes in movies involve mirrors. Like if you look up, I forget what show or movie it was, but you know that like long shot, it's like they never cut and they zoomed in through the through the mirror to start it and then kept going, and it felt like you were still in the mirror.
I'm not super familiar with what you're referring to, but you know what, probably at like 3 a.m. tonight, I'm going to spring awake and I'm going to be like,
yeah, so, yeah.
But yeah, no. And by the way, this was all pre-computers, pre-CGI. So they actually had to do this correctly. Yeah.
And
you know, with what they had on, with what they had available, and with the director on set as an actor as well, turning in a really great performance.
And so, like, he was improvising or like changing dialogue on the go in certain scenes as well, apparently.
I think I read, that like there wasn't, I don't know if there was a full script or if, you know, Jean Renoir was just allowing the actors to just improvise. But like apparently, again, I was reading Lisette's actor's obituary. Apparently she was only supposed to have like a couple lines, but like Jean Renoir liked her so much and thought that her character clicked so well with the story that he just kept giving her more shit to do.
That makes sense, because she did have a lot of interaction with like everybody. Like her and Octave were like very close and also might have had an affair at some point together.
Oh, he's a little too, like, I'm a pretty friendly guy. I'm not that handsy with everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And just to bring back, like, how many affairs were going on, do you remember during the hunt scene, there's Christine's niece is also there, and she's, like, a very small role, but Andre is just making out with her at some point, and then he looks over at her, and he's like, you know I don't love you, right? And just like says it outright. And she's like, I know.
Yeah. It's cool.
And like, she's jealous of her aunt. And yeah, there's so many layers. And like the web is, it's almost like you have to, it's almost like a time travel movie where you have to connect the timelines, but it's all relationships.
It's like a labyrinth. Yeah. But you know what? I do agree that this is my second time watching this movie. I think it needs a third watch pretty soon. But like, you know, the fact that I was still able to more or less keep up with what was going on, like, I think that's a testament to just the true skill and artistry on display.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's why I do think it deserves masterpiece class. Like, it's a masterclass of film.
Yeah, absolutely. Just moving on from effects, this is normally when we talk about score. If you've been a regular viewer for a while, you know that I'm pretty deaf to score. I don't usually notice it. So I guess I'm turning this over to you, Jason. Did you notice the score at all, or did you have anything to say to it?
I am also in the same boat. I always forget that the score exists. And the only times I notice the score is when it's like a specific song that's like very central and like important. Yeah, like I don't know what the score was like in this movie.
Okay, well, I guess these are the moments when we miss Blake, but
yeah, I guess there are some.
I guess we'll just move on from that one then. In terms of legacy, and I guess we'll rope in sequels, prequels, and remakes. In terms of sequels, I know that Robert Altman famously really, really liked this movie. He famously had a quote where he said, "The rules of the game taught me the rules of the game." And if you know anything about Altman, he does a lot of similar things in his movie where it's like a large ensemble cast with no clear main character and like stuff like that. We should do Nashville at some point. I remember watching that in film school and it was a really, really, really great movie. He does have another film. I think it came out in 2001 called Gosford Park, which is kind of almost considered like a spiritual successor to this movie.
That's awesome.
So it's sort of about a bunch of rich assholes being rich assholes. And so maybe we should also look into that.
That just reminded me, like I've mentioned Parasite and Saltburn, but this might fit it better. Knives Out.
Oh yeah.
It's not the same, but it's very similar.
You know, I still haven't fucking seen Knives Out, and I know that I really,
they're both
really need
like
to.
Very good modern movies. Like it's like they're somewhat far and few between when you're trying to find them, and especially since we're focused on older movies. But that's a pretty, they're solid movies, both of them.
Yeah, for sure. And just jumping back a bit, in terms of prequels, there's not really a clear one, but I do know that apparently Jean Renoir, he was really heavily inspired by Alfred de Musset's 1833 play Les Caprices de Marianne, i.e. The Moods of Marianne. And again, I apologize for how I've butchered the French language so far today. But yeah, apparently that was a huge inspiration for this movie.
Citizen Kane, actually, Orson Welles actually... he said, like, this was the influence of Citizen Kane.
Okay, interesting. We should probably do Citizen Kane.
Yeah, I know.
I
think that's
right?
So. The only reason I think I haven't wanted to do it is because everyone knows to do that one if you're getting into film. So I've always been like looking for the other ones, but I know I should watch that one as well.
I guess. I mean, how many? I mean, again, this is one of those moments where we really wish Blake was here. How many episodes have we actually done? No idea, right?
I know we're over 50, maybe 60 by now. So that's at least like 40 movies, because at first we were doing full episodes, and then now we're doing the primer and spoilers.
Primer and the deep dive. Maybe for like our 100th episode, we should do Citizen Kane.
Yeah, something deserves... like. Yeah, Citizen Kane deserves something like that, I think.
Maybe, or like maybe even our 200th episode or something.
Yeah, there's so many good movies to watch. I want to explore more French films after this.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, I'll just say, when we were thinking about, and I'm just pulling up our WhatsApp conversations that we were having. Apparently in 1946, there was a French Beauty and the Beast that apparently heavily inspired the Disney version. And I saw some clips from it and I was like, oh shit, like I want to do that.
Yeah.
And then you had also pitched, I think it's called Un Homme et une Femme, a trilogy of movies from 1966, 1986, and 2019 that all have the same actors.
Yeah. So like the two love interests, because as I said in our conversation, are all French movies purely about love or not? But that one actually explores two, like, I don't know if they're a couple, but like two lovers in three different timelines of their life with the same actors, which is pretty fucking cool.
That is really fucking cool and not something you can accomplish easily.
Another one I was considering, I don't know anything about it, but Hiroshima Mon Amour.
Oh, never even heard of it.
Yeah, so that one sound good. And then Emily Poulain is a classic as well. I know nothing about it again.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I mean, maybe you and I should start our own, like, sub-podcast called, like, VCR, like, France Edition, where you and I just talk about French movies.
We would need double the hours in the day.
We would. That's true. We both have a lot going on. That's not... Okay, let me rephrase. You have a lot. You and Blake have a lot going on. Just jumping ahead a bit. Personal reviews and the partner factor. Do you want to start?
Yeah, I guess... Like, overall, I think I've said my personal reviews. If I was to sum it up, I would say this was a very chaotic watch. Where yeah. I was trying so hard to, like... grasp everything, and I couldn't. It was like there was too much going on. You get thrown in right away, and I'm like looking at all of these things, and like I had to do a lot of research after it to be able to speak about this, and I didn't know the historical context exactly. I didn't know, like, I knew it was 1939, but I didn't know like the whole connection to like what Jean Renoir was trying to do with this until I pieced it together after through research. So I definitely want to watch it again.
This is really one of those movies where you almost want to watch our primer episode before you actually watch the movie itself, you know?
Yeah. And Annabelle only caught like glimpses of this. She was busy, but so the partner factor, she was like, animals were harmed in the making of this movie.
Well, you know, Annabelle is not wrong. I think a lot of animals were harmed in the making of this movie.
Yeah. So overall, yeah, like I do put it into the realm of masterclass, like masterpiece movies. I don't know how strongly it deserves to be there, but from one watch, I can place it up there.
Yeah, I would agree. In terms of my personal review, I really liked this movie. Like, it took me a little bit to get into it, but once I was in, I was in. You know, I had a really good time, particularly with that second hour and the third act. In terms of partner factor, I am currently partnerless, so I can't really speak to that. But if I had a partner, I would have forced him or her to watch it. So
they
and they might have enjoyed it. So if you subscribe to our Patreon, maybe we'll have a tier where you can be my partner and then you can weigh in on that part of
Michael's partner of the week.
Michael's partner of the week, and you can weigh in on what you thought.
So would you use this as a like a test movie for a potential partner?
That's a really good point. I don't know. When I start dating again, maybe I will start putting this movie on and just see how they react to it.
Yeah.
And if they're like, what the fuck is this? Can you put on like Survivor or something? That's also a super dated reference. I'd be like, oh, you can watch whatever you want when you get out of here and get out of my life.
Yeah, exactly. There are some movies where like you put it on and you're just watching them and you're like, do they get it?
Can I confess something just to you and our, I guess, half dozen listeners? Sometimes I will pretend I haven't seen a movie just so I can watch it with another person and just see how they react to it.
It's fucking smart.
It is. I'll be like, oh, wow, I've never seen this movie. Let's put it on. And then I'll be like, oh, interesting. Like, what did you think about that?
Yeah. It's a good play, especially at the beginning of a relationship.
Sometimes I don't even do that in relationships. Sometimes I just do that with friends or my mom. I'll be like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, what do you think about this? And then I think it's like because I'm an artist, I react to things very differently. So sometimes I just like seeing how, and I'm not saying this condescendingly, like normal people will react to things.
Yeah, you are abnormal, so that's fair.
I'm super weird. Like, yeah. I need, it's almost like a grounding experience.
Yeah, it's like you have to see what you're supposed to feel.
Yeah, like I'm an alien studying human emotion. Like, yeah. Interesting, taking notes. Like, so, yeah.
I don't know where we're at now, but...
I think we're more or less done. Unless you have anything else you want to bring up that we haven't brought up yet.
I guess, I don't know, location, like that. They picked some great locations. I think they were in France. Like the chateau itself was pretty cool. And just the other characters, how they were not really a part of it, but there were like a few extra like secondary or tertiary characters in the background. Like, you got to see some, there was this one man who I think was a female actress or a very androgynous, it looked like David Bowie was in there.
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about. It's just a very pretty young man, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I think I know who you're talking about. I didn't really catch who that was, but I definitely saw him or her.
Yeah, she looked like this, who's that really tall blonde actress that's a comedian in a bunch of like newer movies? She's in 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Oh, Elizabeth Banks?
I don't know, but she's like this hilarious, it looked like her.
Oh, almost Tig Notaro? Exactly.
No, not her.
Okay, she is
blonde, she's... and tall and funny, like taller than Tig.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look that up too. Who the fuck is that?
Jane Lynch.
Oh, Jane Lynch, yeah. She's amazing. Yeah,
so this character, this actor, looked exactly like Jane Lynch, just dropped into 1939. But other than that, we get, like, the general is kind of important and, like, has an interesting role. The chef gets a few lines when they're being very racist. We didn't even bring up the racism.
Oh, yeah, there is some unfortunate things in this 90-year-old movie.
I don't know, like, there was Jewish commentary that I don't know how that would have gone over at that time, or how to think about it for that time, because obviously it's a very trying time for the Jewish population, and they're they have different names for them, which I won't repeat in case they are racist.
There's also, and we were talking about this before we started this episode, there's, so Robert collects like these weird knickknacks and music box, and he has like a, I don't really know how to say this, but it's basically like a black woman caricature figurine that plays music, and he sets it down on his desk, and then we get an extreme close-up of it, and I'm like, no, pull away. I don't want to see it.
Yeah.
So
those instruments and like the mechanical things that he collects are pretty cool. And I don't like that. You did mention like how it fits with his character a little bit, I think, where like he just collects these things to keep his mind off of the game or something like that. I don't know exactly how that
collector. I think he's just this. It's like I said, he's Bruce Wayne if he wasn't Batman. He's just passing the time, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, that is something. And also, if you are sensitive to animal cruelty, there is a rabbit genocide in this movie. So you're going to want to be aware of that.
The placement of us telling this in our two episodes at the very end is
this is why we need Blake, because Blake would have said something right away, but we're like at the end and we're like, oh, hey.
By the way. But overall, like, I don't know how, like, we could keep talking about this movie for so long because there's so much that happened. I don't know how well we did in covering all the events and like the characters and like interactions, because it's such a web. I think we did our best.
We did our best. That's a great way of putting it. We did our best. So
it's a worthwhile movie. Anybody should go check it out. Watch it with someone who maybe you could pretend haven't seen it with.
That's my move. Only I get to do that. Yeah. But it's honestly, like, I do feel like I could have shown this movie to my mom and been like, actually, it's funny. I was visiting my mother last weekend and we were planning on watching it together, but I had plans with friends or whatever, and you know. But I feel like I could have watched this movie with my mom and she would have enjoyed it. Like, it actually is, it's more accessible than a movie this old has any right to be.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where it would be difficult for a lot of modern viewers who haven't delved into film to just sit down and watch, but it is a lot more accessible than you think it would be.
I've seen movies from like the 70s or the 80s that aren't as accessible as this fucking French movie from 1939. So
yeah, exactly.
Make of that what you will. I've seen movies from like the early 2000s that aren't as accessible as this movie. So,
yeah, exactly.
But I think that's partly the form. Like, it's a farce. It's a comedy of manners, you know. I think the opening, like, the opening text refers to it as, like, a, like, dramatic fantasy, and that's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I still don't know if all movies that French people do are purely about sex and love, but...
Well...
I'm willing to find out more, because this was enjoyable, and... Yeah, I'd watch some more French films, even if they are just about love. I'm curious to see one that isn't.
Yeah, I guess so. Sound off in the comments if you can help us with that. And when we get our Patreon sorted out, maybe we'll have a specific tier will be Michael and Jason watching French movies that may or may not be about love and adultery.
Yes, yes, that would be ideal.
That would be ideal. And then maybe, I don't know, if for an even higher tier, it'll be Jason and Blake looking at Icelandic films about, I don't know.
Something.
Something, yeah. I really didn't think this joke all the way through. I just started talking, but here we are.
I would say Icelandic movies about how everybody there is an author. And that would be a good one for you.
That would be a good one. I would have to get in on that. So, yeah. Keep an eye out for our Patreon that does not exist yet.
And on the Patreon, you can pay to have us do more threesomes. I mean, like, episodes where yeah. all three of us are on there.
We don't do that enough. I get, like, we're both, all three of us are just so busy. So, like, we, yeah, we actually do, actually, we should say, we have our 2010 draft episode coming out pretty soon.
And it's gonna I have be, to get caught up.
I do too. But basically, yeah, it'll be me, Jason, and Blake looking at, you know, we're looking at our top picks for the 2010s, and it's all going to be divided into genres. And yeah, it should be a pretty fun episode. It won't be fun to edit because it'll be three audio streams, but that is Blake's problem.
So yeah, thanks for listening to Vintage Cinema Rewind, and we hope you liked this little foray into the French persuasion.
Into the Blakeless episodes with just Michael and Jason. But yeah, let us know if you don't want Blake, if you want less Blake in this podcast. actually don't. But you know, I'm going to say this, but then a bunch of people are just going to be like, we want less Michael. And I'll be like, ah, I played myself. Like,
yeah, yeah. Oui, merci,
oui. Mon ami. Yes. French words.
All right, do we cut it here? I don't know. Blake normally cuts me off. I don't know
what yeah, to do. He normally cuts me off too, so I guess this is as good as time as any. Tell your dad.
Tell your dad, tell your grandpa, tell your affair lovers, and yeah, bonjour.
Aloha.
Au revoir.